Good morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Thursday, March 2nd, 2006. I'm Chris Andre.
Carlos Chavez.
Coming up, Oregon could lose $66 million a year in Medicaid money under new spending rules. Bush has signed a deal with India that overturns the nuclear non-proliferation treaty, in effect taking the world to a new level of danger. In Karachi, Pakistan, a bomb at the U.S. consulate killed four people, one of them an American diplomat. Portland area weather today, showers, isolated thunderstorms on the coast, snow showers over 2,000 feet, highs around 50 tonight, chance of showers to the north, lows 30 to 40.
Oregon's boom or bust system of financing state government is hitting pay dirt. The state can expect to get $700 million more in taxes and lottery profits for the 2005-2007 budget cycle than expected. For the 2005 budget cycle than expected when lawmakers wrote the budget. Most of the money will be sent back to taxpayers and corporations in 2007 thanks to the state's one-of-a-kind kicker law. That requires tax rebates when revenues come in higher than projected. Lawmakers could vote to suspend the kicker rebates, but that requires a two-thirds vote in the House and Senate. That means the bonanza of tax revenues may not be available to fill a $172 million hole in the state human services funding, which could force thousands of Oregonians off health assistance or other programs. Democrats hope to use some of the extra money to plug the gap in human services funding and perhaps boost aid to schools and universities. Most Republicans say the money should go back in tax rebates. Some lawmakers in both parties will suggest putting at least some of the money into reserves to protect Oregon services when the next recession hits. Disagreements over the kicker law could spark a major fight if lawmakers come back to Salem to rebalance the state budget and address human services shortfall. A special session of the legislature may be called as soon as June. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
Oregon could lose $66 million a year in Medicaid money under new spending rules from the Bush administration. This further jeopardizes the state's ability to provide health care to low-income people. Governor Kulongoski said he and his aides recently made progress in reducing an expected $172 million shortfall in Oregon's human services budget for 2005-2007. But the new federal rules could leave the department and its beneficiaries in a more precarious position. Kulongoski was in Washington for a meeting of the National Governors Association. He also huddled on Tuesday with members of Oregon's delegation to Congress to brief them on the state's predicament and ask their help in softening the blow. Senator Gordon Smith, the lone Republican in the meeting, said he would try to help, but Smith also said the delegation could do little to help Oregon specifically. The new spending rules required under the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005 must apply to all states equally. This from the Oregonian.
State regulators today will jump into the controversy stirred up by the City of Portland's claims that Portland General Electric has been overcharging its customers tens of millions of dollars annually. For months, the Oregon Public Utility Commission has watched from the sidelines as city commissioners have criticized PGE's rates and launched an investigation into the utility's income tax and power trading practices. Today, it will break its silence and present its own report on whether PGE's rates need to be reassessed and whether, as some city commissioners suggest, those rates should be reduced. The controversy places the PUC in a difficult situation because the agency is responsible for regulating investor-owned utilities. Portland's criticism of PGE has served as an indirect scolding of the PUC, raising questions about whether regulators adequately monitored the utility. The report's findings will not be disclosed until this morning at PUC headquarters in Salem. Few expect any big surprises from an agency that already has conducted extensive rate proceedings and power trading investigations exploring PGE's practices. This from the Oregonian.
The effort to repeal public campaign financing of Portland's political campaigns failed for a second time this week. City elections regulators ruled that the First Things First Committee, a coalition of business leaders and corporations, did not gain enough signatures to qualify for the May ballot. They had already ruled out once, but city, county, and state elections officials went back through repeal petition sheets during the past week after discovering two problems with the original count. First, a glitch in the state's new voter registration database meant that some signatures from registered voters were not counted. And secondly, the city elections officer did not sort through the 5,212 petition sheets filed by the First Things First committee to ensure that all of them met state guidelines. After another review last week, the county restored 49 signatures from people who were mistakenly excluded. But regulators removed 186 petition sheets because they weren't signed or dated properly. The bottom line, more signatures got thrown out than were added back.
If the logging of trees killed by the 2002 Biscuit Fire has seemed contentious so far, it's about to get even more so. U.S. Forest Service officials say they soon will auction the first burned timber within undeveloped roadless areas. The roadless cutting is likely to be the most controversial part of a Bush administration plan to salvage thousands of truckloads of logs blackened by the 500,000-acre fire in southwest Oregon. Environmental activists prize the roadless lands because they are considered undisturbed, with potential to become protected wilderness. Ted Kulongoski asked the administration to keep loggers out of Biscuit's roadless areas, which were protected by a rule issued at the end of the Clinton administration. The Bush administration replaced that rule with a new process. Kulongoski is pursuing two strategies, a lawsuit and petition, to reinstate the Clinton era roadless protections. The governor will urge the Forest Service to hold off on its roadless cutting in the meantime. Logging until now has avoided the roadless lands, focusing instead on less contested acreage designated for commercial cutting and older forest reserves. Environmental groups sued to stop some of the logging, but courts rejected most of their claims. This from the Oregonian.
The Federal Election Commission has imposed an $11,000 fine on the campaign of Republican Senator Gordon Smith for reporting violations related to loans from the candidate to his Senate campaign committee. The FEC dismissed other charges against Smith, his campaign, and his wife Sharon, filed by state Democrats and former state candidate Bill Bradbury. The complaints were filed in 2002 and referred to loans provided to Smith's two bids for the Senate in 1996. Bradbury filed a complaint with the FEC a few weeks before the election, charging that Smith had misrepresented personal funds used to pay off a $1.6 million line of credit that went into his 1996 campaigns. In the process, Bradbury said Smith accepted an illegal campaign contribution from his wife that exceeded federal limits by nearly $500,000. 2 months later, the state Democratic Party filed a complaint charging that $1.6 million loan did not have enough collateral and was granted with sweetheart terms. The FEC, in a ruling announced this week, found there was no reason to believe a violation had occurred in regard to either complaint. Smith converted the debt to a personal loan after winning election in November of 1996 and paid off the loan in 2000. Eyebrows in Salem remain raised.
Any salmon fishermen hoping for a better season in 2006 may want to put that thought off for a couple years. Pacific Fishery Management Council salmon advisor Don Stevens said he has been going over federal reviews of the 2005 season, sending out dozens of emails to commercial salmon fishermen and fishing industry groups and calling state and federal representatives. Stevens is already gearing up to request a federal declaration of economic disasters for the ocean troll salmon industry of the West Coast. He says the situation is worse than he's seen in 10 years. Last year, recreational fishermen were relatively unaffected by restrictions concerning Klamath River Chinook, but Southern Oregon commercial trawlers sat out most of the summer at the dock, unable to fish due to potential impacts on low returns. The concern was about allowing fishing on stocks that must have at least 35,000 wild fish returned to the Klamath River. Fishery managers limited fishing as much as they could, but still counted on having enough Chinook to reach the Klamath to meet the 35,000 fish in escapement floor, but it didn't happen. Only 27,300 adult fish returned. Now even the early March fishing season opening is in doubt, given the new Klamath review numbers and forecast for 2006.
Portland-based Mercy Corps has opened its official Gulf Coast headquarters in New Orleans. Mercy Corps has committed to spend at least a year helping rebuild neighborhoods throughout the region. Following the six-month anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, a briefing will be issued today in Portland. The International Aid Agency's largest ever domestic relief effort has extended as far as coastal Mississippi, but the 11-person Gulf Coast staff has found aid work there to be equally, if not more, challenging than in global crisis in Indonesia and Liberia. Mercy Corps has raised more than $11 million for hurricane relief and has $5.5 million yet to spend. Aid workers are now trying to help neighborhood associations navigate the process of resettlement. This from the Oregonian.
A rare California condor egg was laid February 16th at the Oregon Zoo's Johnson Center for Wildlife Conservation. If the egg survives and a chick hatches about 2 months from now, it will be the fifth since the zoo opened California's condor captive breeding operation late in 2003. The zoo's program is one of four nationwide contributing captive-bred condors to a species that was nearly extinct two decades ago when just 22 remained. On November 30, 2005, when the most recent count was taken, the population stood at 273 birds, with 176 in captivity and 127 flying free in California, Arizona, and Mexico. The mother, Tama, estimated to be more than 30 years old, lived up to her reputation as a reliable breeder when she produced her newest egg in a sand-filled nest box at the zoo's breeding facility in a remote Clackamas County meadow. The site is off-limits to the public. About 2 weeks ago, keepers suspected there was an egg as they watched Tama and her mate, Mandan, take turns spending time in the nest box, a dark wood cave built high off the ground. The nest is equipped with a surveillance camera, but she laid the egg just out of the camera's range.
Before Hurricane Katrina hit, federal disaster officials warned President Bush and his Homeland Security chief that the storm could breach levees, put lives at risk in New Orleans, Superdome, and overwhelm rescuers, according to confidential video footage. Bush didn't ask a single question during the final briefing before Katrina struck on August 29th, but he assured soon-to-be-battered state officials, "We are fully prepared." The footage, along with 7 days of transcripts of briefings obtained by the Associated Press, show in excruciating detail the federal officials fully anticipated the tragedy that unfolded in New Orleans and elsewhere along the Gulf Coast. Yet, they were fatally slow to realize that they had not mustered enough resources to deal with the unprecedented disaster. The White House and Homeland Security Department urged the public yesterday not to read too much into the video footage. Homeland Security spokesman Russ Knock said his department would not release the full set of videotaped briefings. Knock said most of the transcripts from the sessions were provided to congressional investigators months ago.
James Dobson, head of the evangelical Christian group Focus on the Family, has received a personal note from Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito, commending them for their help in the confirmation process. This from the Raw Story. The letter was posted by Progress Action Now. The group has also posted audio of Dobson reading the letter during his radio broadcast. Here is the text of the letter. "This is just a short note to express my heartfelt thanks to you and the entire staff of Focus on the Family for your help and support during the past few challenging months. I would also greatly appreciate it if you would convey my appreciation to the good people from all parts of the country who wrote to tell me they were praying for me and for my family during this period. As I said when I spoke at my formal vestiture at the White House last week, the prayers of so many people from around the country were a palpable and powerful force. As long as I serve on the Supreme Court, I will keep in mind the trust that has been placed on me. I hope we'll have the opportunity to meet personally at some point in the future. In the meantime, my entire family and I hope that you and Focus on the Family staff know how much we appreciate all that you have done. Sincerely yours, Samuel Alito.
Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez appeared to suggest yesterday that the Bush administration's warrantless domestic surveillance operations may extend beyond the outlines that the president acknowledged in mid-December. In a letter yesterday to senators, in which he asked to clarify his February testimony to the Senate Judiciary Committee, Gonzalez also seemed to imply that the administration's original legal justification for the program was not as clear-cut as he indicated 3 weeks ago at that appearance. Gonzalez confined his comments to the National Security Agency's warrantless wiretapping program, saying that President Bush had authorized it and that that is all that he has authorized. But in yesterday's letter, Gonzalez, citing that quote, wrote, "I did not and could not address any other classified intelligence activities," using the administration's term for the recently disclosed operations. He continued, "I was confining my remarks to the terrorist surveillance program as described by the president, the legality of which was the subject of the February 6th hearing." At least one constitutional scholar who testified before the committee yesterday said that Gonzalez appeared to be hinting that the operation disclosed by the New York Times in mid-December is not the full extent of eavesdropping on U.S. residents conducted without court warrants. This from the Washington Post.
A federal judge in Miami has ruled the U.S. should not have deported 15 Cuban migrants who in January reached a disused bridge in the Florida Keys. But Judge Federico Moreno said his ruling would not affect the wet foot, dry foot policy under which Cubans stopped at sea are usually sent back. The group was deported because the bridge no longer connected to land. They now hope to leave Cuba legally, but it's unclear whether the communist government will allow them to go. The U.S. Coast Guard had argued that the broken bridge did not count as U.S. soil, and therefore the Cubans could not seek residency. The deportation in January infuriated the political influential Cuban-American community in Florida. They wanted the court to define U.S. soil as anywhere within U.S. territorial waters. Exile groups believed Cubans trying to reach the U.S. should be allowed to stay because they say they are fleeing an oppressive government. Last month, Florida Senator Mel Martinez, a Republican, called for an overhaul of the wet foot, dry foot policy, which he described as a complete and utter failure. Correspondents say the policy has become more stringent in the recent years. The number of Cuban boat people has been rising recently, with nearly 3,000 intercepted in the last fiscal year. This from the BBC.
President Bush scored a victory today on his first trip to India, a landmark nuclear energy agreement that he says could ease U.S. energy prices. Bush acknowledged it will be difficult to persuade Congress to support the agreement in which the United States would share its nuclear know-how and fuel with India. But, he said, he's confident Congress will approve the deal anyway, so India can power its fast-growing economy without expanding the world demand for oil. Critics in Congress say the United States is making an exception for India, which has nuclear weapons but won't sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Critics say the United States is using India as a counterweight to China's growing economic and political influence. And they argue that the agreement sends the wrong signal to leaders of North Korea and Iran, who have thumbed their noses at international monitoring of their weapons programs. The late-night negotiations on a nuclear pact, coupled with protests planned throughout Bush's stay, reflected India's mixed feelings about the visit by the leader of the United States, a country seen as a loyal friend by some and a global bully by others. Anti-Bush protests continue across India today.
Shark brain implants that could turn the fish into stealth spies are being studied in a research project funded by the Pentagon, according to a Telegraph. Swimming in a ship's wake, a remote-controlled shark could track an enemy vessel's movements without being noticed and under its own power. The Navy also hopes to exploit sharks' natural ability to sense delicate electrical gradients and allow and follow chemical trails left by a vessel. The research builds on development in brain implant technology, which have already seen scientists controlling the movements of fish, rats, and monkeys. Walter Gomez of the Naval Undersea Warfare Center in Newport, Rhode Island, said the team's next step would be to implant the device into blue sharks and release them into the ocean off the coast of Florida. The project, funded by the U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, is described today in New Scientist. Another group led by Professor Jele Atema at Boston University has already used implants in the olfactory center of the brain to steer spiny dogfish in a tank using radio commands sent to an antenna on the fish that stands proud of the surface.
According to the BBC, Europe has become a happy hunting ground for foreign intelligence agencies. The Human Rights Watchdog, the Council of Europe, has been investigating claims of illegal detentions and transport of prisoners by the CIA. Council Chairman Terry Davis, who presented the report, said safeguards were needed to prevent abuse. His report found no new evidence of secret prisons on European territory. The U.S. says it has not broken any law. Davis said a number of countries had systems for overseeing their own national security services, such as exist in the U.K. But he said hardly any country in Europe has any legal provisions to ensure an effective oversight over the activities of foreign agencies on their territory. The report follows a request by Davis in November for the Council's 46 member states to submit information relating to suspicions that the CIA had run secret jails in Europe. Davis also asked them to reveal anything they knew about secret CIA flights across Europe in which prisoners are alleged to have been transferred to jails in third countries where they face torture and other abuses.
The former UN human rights chief for Iraq said yesterday that officials overseeing Baghdad's morgue have come under pressure not to investigate the soaring numbers of apparent cases of executions and torture in the country. John Pace, who left his post in Iraq earlier this month, spoke as Iraqi and U.S. officials offered widely varying numbers for the toll so far in the explosion of sectarian violence that followed last Wednesday's bombing of a Shiite shrine in Samarra. Pace said the pressure has come from both sides, but declines to give further details. The statement appeared to refer both the Shiite-led government and the Sunni insurgency that fighting it. Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari said yesterday that the death toll provided to Washington Post by Baghdad morgue workers, more than 1,300 dead since last Wednesday, was inaccurate and exaggerated. Al-Jafari said the toll was 379. General Ali Shamari of the Interior Ministry Statistics Department put the toll at 1,077. U.S. and Iraqi officials offered figures yesterday, both higher and lower than Al-Jafari's count. The U.S. military said it had confirmed 220 deaths.
South Africans have voted in local elections, seen as a big test for the African National Congress. The ANC has governed the country since 1994. President Thabo Mbeki cast his vote, he urged South Africans to turn out at polling stations in large numbers. However, although the ANC is expected to win most seats, voter turnout appears to have been low across the country. Frustration over the slow pace of service delivery has caused frustration and occasionally led to violence. The Independent Electoral Commission, the IEC, reported that all stations were operating by the afternoon. In Cape Town, power cuts mean vote counting is set to take place by candlelight. Despite huge support nationally, the ANC has performed poorly at local level, with the absence of a strong, credible opposition weakening the country's young democracy. Former President Nelson Mandela voted near his home in Johannesburg's Houghton suburb. Mandela said, "Even if I go to my grave, I will wake up and come and vote."
Militants in southern Nigeria have released six members of a group of nine foreign oil workers they have been holding hostage since February 18th. This is from the BBC. Five of them, two Egyptians, two Thais, and one Filipino, were taken to the office of the state governor. A U.S. man was handed to journalists earlier. Another two Americans and one Briton are still being held. The militants have been demanding a greater share of the region's oil wealth for local Ijaw people. Their attacks have led to a 20% drop in Nigeria's oil exports. The group of nine are all employees of the U.S. oil services company, Will Brothers. They were seized on a boat while laying a pipeline for Shell. The six hostages were brought in to the town of Wadi in two batches following their release earlier on Wednesday. Delta State Governor James Ibori said he was very pleased that the six had been freed, but appealed to the group for the release of the remaining three.
The ongoing cycle of violence in the Palestinian-occupied territories has claimed two more lives. Manar Gibran has the latest.
When his car exploded, witnesses say an Israeli warjet fired a missile at his vehicle, but Israel denies involvement. In the West Bank, an Israeli settler is dead after he was shot in the head at the gas station where he worked. Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade claimed responsibility. Early this morning, a large Israeli force of at least six military vehicles invaded the West Bank village of Beit Fajar near Bethlehem and declared the village a closed military zone. The soldiers conducted a house-to-house search and arrested 12 Palestinian youth. The Israeli army has been carrying out arrest campaigns among Palestinian civilians, claiming that the arrestees are wanted members of armed resistance groups. Many of these arrest attempts end with assassinations. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Palestine, this is Manar Jibrin.
The annual parade competition at Brazil's famous Rio de Janeiro Carnival has been won by a Venezuelan-sponsored samba group. The Baila Isabel group, which was declared the winner after a dance-off, had Latin community unity as its theme. Baila Isabel's president, Wilson Moises Alves, thanked Venezuela's national oil company, PDVSA, for its funding. PDVSA will not say how much money was involved, but reports estimate its donation at more than $500,000. It is Vila Isabel's second Carnival victory following on from a win in 1988. The Vila Isabel procession featured floats showcasing the Brotherhood of Latin Americans, including a huge effigy of Simon Bolivar, and the 1960s anthem dedicated to the left called "I'm Crazy About You, America." Images of Saddam Hussein and former Argentine military ruler Jorge Rafael Videla were also controversially on show at the Samba Parade. The Samba competition, which takes place in front of a panel of 40 judges and 70,000 spectators in the city's Sambadrome, is the crescendo to 4 days of partying across the city and country. The dozens of samba groups battling it out are judged not just on their dancing, but their music, staging, and even response of the crowd. This has been the Cable Morning News for Thursday, February 2nd, 2006. Chris Andre edited the news. Cable's volunteer audio engineers edited the tape, and Cable's intrepid reporters contributed local stories. Kathleen Stevenson is the AM News and Public Affairs Director, and Boone Rivas is on the board right now. I'm Carlos Chavez.
And I'm Chris Andre.
We welcome your participation in the AM Newsroom. The volunteer to volunteer, call us at 503-231-8032, extension 202. Reach us by email at amnews@kbu or drop by the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. The KBU website is www.kbu.fm. We clear the air at 90.7 FM Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis on translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on translator K220HR. Be sure to join us at 5 p.m. for a solid hour of news on the KBU Evening News. Portland area weather today, showers, isolated thunderstorms on the coast, snow showers above 200 feet, highs around 50. Tonight, a chance of showers to the north, lows 30 to 40. Coming up this morning on KBU,